From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, as a US government shutdown looms, the blame game is underway on Capitol Hill.
I'm Alice Olstein, and I'll have the latest on the negotiations between Republicans and Democrats to keep the government open.
Also on the program, the battle to keep rural hospitals open in Colorado, the fight in Greece against neo-fascism, the hunt for Britain's White Widow.
It's not the Samantha that we knew. She was a gentle, normal, average British young girl.
And a report from Moscow after more Greenpeace activists were remanded into custody by a Russian court. All that and more on this edition of FSN Reports, after our latest roundup of today's main news stories.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. The United States is bracing for the shutdown of the federal government if Congress can't reach a deal. But US President Barack Obama says he's not at all resigned to a shutdown. From Washington, Daniel Renches reports.
Government departments here in Washington and federal agencies across the country are readying for a shutdown starting on Tuesday because Democrats and Republicans seem more ready to play the blame game rather than compromise their basic bargaining positions. A section of the Republican parties demanding a delay on President Obama's signature healthcare reform, which they want to get rid of, in exchange for authorizing the continuing funding of government.
I am not at all resigned.
But the president's not ruling out a last-minute deal.
The Senate has passed a bill that keeps the government open, does not have a lot of extraneous issues to it, that allows us then to negotiate a longer-term budget.
The shutdown would preclude services deemed essential, such as the military, police, and disaster response operations. Daniel Renches, Washington.
A court in Russia's Murmansk has arrested the remaining eight members of the Arctic Sunrise crew, who were detained on September 19th. They'll join 22 fellow activists, including a freelance videographer and photographer, jailed on Thursday last week on piracy charges. Greenpeace rejected the accusations as absurd and pledged to appeal the court's ruling. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
All of the 30 arrested crew members of the Arctic Sunrise icebreaker who protested against oil drilling in the Arctic face charges of piracy. They will have to spend 2 months in custody until November 24th while the court decides whether their action was a criminal act. The judge considered the suspects may otherwise continue criminal activity, destroy evidence, or attempt to flee the country. No charges have yet officially been brought in the case. Meanwhile, Russian authorities continue inspecting the Greenpeace ship, Russia's investigative committee said in a statement. They have seized some equipment and documents which are being studied to, quote, find out the purposes which it might have been used for. Greenpeace denounced the allegations, saying its peaceful action didn't constitute a crime. The legal team working with the defendants in Murmansk is appealing the court's decision. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
A number of senior members of the Greek neo-fascist party Golden Dawn have been arrested on charges including assault and money laundering. Party leader Nikos Michaliliakos had earlier been charged over belonging to a criminal organisation. It's the first time in nearly 30 years Greece has witnessed the arrest of a party leader. The party members were held amid public outcry over the recent murder of an anti-fascist rap artist, Pavlos Fissas, who was fatally stabbed by a suspect claiming to be a supporter of Golden Dawn. The party has rejected the claims. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Italy's government will face a parliamentary vote of confidence on Wednesday after former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi pulled his party's ministers out of the coalition. Prime Minister Enrico Letta is hoping Parliament will back his centre-left grouping to avoid having to call national elections. Our Europe editor Sandra Gatman has more.
In the latest display of cracks in Italy's ruling coalition, patched together after inconclusive elections last February, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi pulled five of his centre-right party's ministers from the Italian administration after a disagreement over proposed tax hikes. In response to Saturday's resignations, Prime Minister Enrico Letta accused Berlusconi of drawing attention away from his personal legal troubles. Several of Berlusconi's party members have also claimed they were forced to leave and that the walkout was decided without party consent. Prime Minister Letta is now hoping to get the support of the Italian Parliament to allow his current coalition to continue in power. The International Monetary Fund has already warned that prolonged political uncertainty will threaten Italy's struggling economy and destabilize recovery efforts across the Eurozone. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
At least 51 people have been killed and dozens wounded after a series of car bombs struck Shiite neighbourhoods across the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. This just the latest attack to add to a relentless wave of violence in the country. No group has claimed responsibility for the bloodshed, but the country's interior ministry blames Al-Qaeda-linked militants. The retrial of American Amanda Knox in the death of her British roommate in 2007 has begun in Florence, Italy. The court will re-examine the case after Knox's conviction was initially thrown out in 2011 for lack of evidence. Amanda Knox has not returned to Italy for the trial. If convicted again, Knox will be ordered to return to Italy. If she refuses, Italy could request her extradition from the United States. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports, a brand new programme, and we're excited to be bringing it to you. The sands of time are expiring in Washington ahead of a possible federal government shutdown. Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill insist they plan to stand firm, but President Obama said today he isn't resigned to the prospect of no deal to avert the furloughing of more than 700,000 government workers and the rollback of many government funded services. With the latest machinations from Capitol Hill, correspondent Alice Olstein of Free Speech Radio News.
Just hours ahead of what could be the first government shutdown in 17 years, the Senate voted to scrap the budget riders approved by the House over the weekend. Measures to delay the law commonly known as Obamacare for 1 year, permanently repeal a tax on medical devices, and get rid of the Women's Health Amendment. Shortly before the vote, California Democrat Barbara Boxer told reporters that scrapping the Women's Health Amendment would allow private sector employers to deny their workers the following:
guaranteed affordable birth control, screenings for cervical cancer, screenings for sexually transmitted diseases, or STDs, screenings for pregnancy-related diabetes, screenings for domestic violence, and breastfeeding counseling and supplies. And here's the thing. Republicans already lost a vote on this very provision in the United States Senate, and they already lost an election in part because voters rejected their war on women.
As the stripped-down bill went back to the House for consideration, Boxer described some of the potential impacts a government shutdown would have on her home state of California, including the closure of all national parks and a delay in cleaning up toxic waste sites. Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow added that millions of Americans across the country would also be harmed by a government shutdown, aside from hundreds of thousands of furloughed federal employees.
Whether we're talking about someone who just turned 65, wants to sign up for Medicare, for instance, where they won't have the ability to go in and sign up. We see potential threats of veterans payments and disability payments. If you are going on travel with your family, the ability to get a passport, something as simple as that, will not be available.
Several lawmakers, including Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin, said besides the impacts on Americans, a government shutdown would severely damage the international reputation of Congress and the United States.
It is a failure when you cannot keep government open. I think it's unfortunate.
As the House debated for long hours this past weekend, Republicans claimed they were putting forward a compromise because the bill delayed the president's health care law instead of entirely repealing or defunding it. Senator Stabenow insisted Monday that Democrats are also compromising, but said there was a line they would not cross.
We are willing to compromise. What we're not willing to do is stop tens of millions of Americans from being able to get health care, maybe for the first time for their families.
After House Republicans huddled in their basement meeting room Monday afternoon, they told reporters that GOP leaders plan to introduce a new version of the funding bill that would delay the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate for 1 year and deny insurance subsidies to all lawmakers, their staffers, and the president's political appointees. That debate is expected to continue late into the night, and its outcome will determine whether Tuesday brings the first government shutdown in nearly two decades. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Whatever happens to the federal government in the hours ahead, whether it continues functioning or temporarily shuts down, in many parts of the United States, it's just another day of budgetary uncertainty and financial strain. Hospitals in many rural parts of the country face a continuing crisis, with some facilities at risk of closure as they struggle to make money in an era of budget cuts. FSN's Denver Bureau Chief Steve Mort reports that the financial strain could be endangering lives in parts of rural Colorado.
In rural Colorado, making medicine pay is a daily battle. Todd Oberhue is the president of the Spanish Peaks Regional Health Center in the small town of Walsenburg, south of Pueblo.
We just don't have a big profit center when you're in a rural area. It's very basic. It's your labs and your radiologies and then your primary care and your emergency medicine care. And that's pretty much what you'll see in almost all the rural facilities.
Like many remote communities, Walsenburg's population of just 3,000 is aging rapidly and is relatively poor. A large proportion of its population needs government help to pay for health care. Oberhue says recent cuts in public spending means reimbursements to hospitals like this are falling, leaving towns like Walsenburg in danger of losing their medical facilities.
I know the challenges that they're facing, and because their communities are smaller, it's putting a lot of pressure on them to try to find a way to keep their hospital in their community.
Many people in rural areas lack private health insurance and can't pay for their treatment. High rates of obesity and diabetes put additional pressure on hospital budgets. And that all means rural hospitals don't have sufficient money to attract enough medical staff. The cost crunch leaves many rural hospitals facing closure, in turn putting lives at risk, according to experts. While Walsenburg is fortunate to have a well-equipped medical facility, many similar communities across the United States aren't so lucky, with some people having to travel hundreds of miles just to get the critical medical care they need. A new study by Colorado investigative news organization iNews shows the majority of U.S. traffic fatalities happen on rural roads, even though only 20% of Americans live in rural areas. Dr. Gregory Jakovich is chief of surgery at the Denver Health Medical Center.
The more rural you are, the more remote you are, the more far away that this injury occurs from definitive care, the higher your mortality rate is.
Emergency management officials in Colorado acknowledge that the distances involved are made even more problematic by a lack of transportation. Randy Kuykendall, Deputy Director of Emergency Medical and Trauma Service Programs at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, says small populations mean ambulance services are also lacking in rural areas, often further delaying emergency medical care.
Ambulance services get paid for transporting people. So when that type of reimbursement model exists, obviously the encouragement is for people to be transported. And in communities where there are fewer and fewer transports, the smaller and smaller the resources exist within that community to provide that public service that's out there.
Meanwhile, the long-term fate of rural hospitals could be tied to the implementation of healthcare reforms. Opponents of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, say cuts in government assistance will hurt rural facilities, while supporters say by insuring more people, the financial future of small hospitals will be more secure. Steve Moore, Denver.
Eight more Greenpeace activists have been remanded into custody by a district court in the northern Russian city of Murmansk. That brings to 30 the number of activists jailed by the Russians, citizens from 18 different countries detained for protesting at a Russian state-owned drilling platform in the Arctic. No charges have yet been brought against the activists, but Russian prosecutors are considering charging them with piracy. FSN's Moscow Bureau Chief Anya Ardayeva reports.
28 activists and two journalists from 18 countries will remain in custody until late November, while the Russian prosecutors decide whether there is enough evidence to charge them with piracy and other offenses. The Greenpeace disagreed with the court ruling. The company's lawyer in Russia, Anton Benislavsky, says the organization plans to use all legal means to get its activists released.
We will fight to get our activists and staff, as well as those from other Greenpeace International offices, released by using all legal means and only legal means available within Russian law and international law as well.
The Arctic Sunrise ship, owned by Greenpeace, was seized by the Russian Coast Guard on September 19th after two activists attempted to scale an offshore Prirazlomne platform owned by the Russian state energy giant Gazprom. The activists insisted their protest was peaceful and armed and was aimed at calling attention to the environmental risks of drilling in Arctic waters. The Russian official said the seizure of the ship, which looked like a scene from an action movie with masked and armed officers descending to the ship from a helicopter, was not aimed at stopping the protest, but at defending the people working at the platform, says the platform's captain Sergei Kostromskoy.
This was a measure forced on us because we saw obvious aggressive attempts to seize the platform. We didn't know what the intentions of these people were. There are diving operations conducted in this area, and so this created a threat for the lives of those involved.
Campaign director for Greenpeace Russia, Ivan Blokhov, described the operation as, quote, the most aggressive and hostile act against the environmentalists since the 1985 bombing of the Rainbow Warrior ship by the French government. Among those being held, two people have no connection to the protest action, Russian freelance photographer Denis Sinikov and British video reporter Kieran Bryan. Russian President Vladimir Putin said last week the activists were not pirates, but said the Coast Guard did the right thing by intercepting the Arctic Sunrise. The Prirazlomne platform, which belongs to Gazprom's oil subsidiary, is the first offshore rig in the Arctic. It was deployed in the Pechora Sea in 2011, but its launch has been delayed. Greenpeace Russia Energy Program Director Vladimir Chuprov.
80% of this platform has been assembled by using second-hand parts from other platforms dating all the way back to 1984. According to statements by the management of the project, up to 80% of the parts have been delivered faulty. They were broken parts.
However, the Russian officials insist that the platform is meeting all the necessary safety standards. Artur Akopov is the director of the oil rig.
We fully recycle all the waste, and what we can't recycle on site, we send ashore for further processing. There could be technological processes that fall outside this regimen, and in that case, we have a plan of action aimed at preventing possible accidents.
The nationals of 18 different countries, including Sweden, Finland, Great Britain, Netherlands, Brazil, Argentina, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Italy, Denmark, Switzerland, Turkey, Poland, France, Russia, and the Arctic Sunrise American captain are to remain in custody until late November. The Russian official said the detainees were kept in individual cells, separately from the Arctic Sunrise crew members and separately from Russian citizens. They said the biggest problem was the lack of interpreters among the detention facility staff. Following the court's ruling, Russia's main investigative agency accused Greenpeace activists of posing a real threat to the security of personnel on a platform, indicating that Moscow plans to prosecute the jail environmentalists for their protest. Anya Ardaeva, Moscow.
Syria's foreign minister says his country is under attack by al-Qaeda-linked militants and that Western nations that pay lip service to fighting terrorism are merely inflaming his country's conflict. That speech before the UN General Assembly came just days after the United Nations Security Council passed a binding resolution calling for the destruction of Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. Joining me from FSN's bureau at the UN in New York, Nick Harper. Nick, a defiant message from the Syrian foreign minister there today?
Absolutely, a very defiant message, and in many ways a very different version of events from the one that the West has been presented. He pretty much turned things on their head. He rejected the West's version of things and said that there was no civil war, that simply the Syrian government was involved in a fight against terrorist networks such as al-Qaeda. And as a result, he suggested that the West was supporting terrorism because it was supporting the opposition. And interestingly, he also talked talked about the Syrian refugees who've left the borders of Syria to various neighbouring countries. They now number more than 2 million, and he said that they should return home. He said that the state would be able to properly protect them and called it inhumane conditions that they're currently facing in the refugee camps.
Nick Harper at UN headquarters in New York, thanks very much. A senior UN official warned on Monday that that refugee crisis that Nick mentioned now threatens economic development throughout the entire region. Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, now heads the UN's development agency, and she said by the end of the year, nearly a quarter of Lebanon's population will consist of refugees. A team of UN inspectors arrived in Beirut on Monday on their way to Syria, where they plan to begin the process of destroying the country's stockpile of chemical weapons. President Bashar al-Assad pledged over the weekend to cooperate with them, even as the Obama administration and others hold him responsible for a chemical weapons attack in the Damascus suburbs last month. He also spoke extensively about his own political past and future in an interview with Italy's Rai 24 television network. Correspondent Monica Maggioni asked President Bashar al-Assad if there were any circumstances under which he would leave office.
If my quit of my position would make the situation better, the answer very simply, without reluctance, yes. But the other question, would that be the situation? That's another question. So for me as president, so far, I have to be in my position, because when you have a storm, you don't give up your position. You don't quit your position and leave your country. Your mission is to take your country to the shore, not to abandon the sheep and the Syrian people.
President Bashar al-Assad of Syria talking there to Monica Maggioni of Italy's Rai 24. You're listening to FSN Reports. To Greece now, where a number of senior members of the neo-fascist party Golden Dawn have been arrested on charges including assault and money laundering. They were held in connection with the murder of an anti-racist musician earlier this month. The suspect held over the musician's stabbing claims to be a member of Golden Dawn. Party leader Mikos Michaloliakos had earlier been charged with belonging to a criminal organisation. Athens-based journalist Menos Zafalias told FSN's Kevin McAleese the Greek government is now hitting Golden Dawn hard.
The government is no longer willing to stand idly by while Golden Dawn seems to be rising in its power and getting more and more active on the political front. And what changed everything was the murder approximately 2 weeks ago because of mass reaction in society. Authorities pushed for legal investigation into the activities of Golden Dawn. Subsequently, the primary evidence led to arrest. It's the first time active MPs have been arrested in Greece since 1967.
Has there been any backlash from the supporters of this far-right party?
The backlash has been very limited. They did get 450,000 votes in elections in 2012. And polls before the murder of Pavlos Fissas showed that they had become Greece's third most popular party, according to latest data. This has fallen. Latest polls show that support for Golden Dawn after the murder has been cut in half, close to 6.5%. But it's still too early to tell.
The Golden Dawn Party, internationally recognised as a neo-Nazi movement, although the party itself denies that, could this be the beginning of the end for Golden Dawn?
This is quite murky. If they come to trial and they are found guilty in a court of law, then these MPs will be put in jail. There will be a procedure on whether to ban Golden Dawn as a party or not.
Journalist Menos Zafalias on the line today from Athens. As investigations into the Westgate terror attack in Nairobi continue, the so-called White Widow is being hunted by global security services. There's currently no clear evidence linking British citizen Samantha Luthwaite to the Westgate siege, but she is known to be involved with the Al-Shabaab militant group and has been on the run in East Africa for several years, wanted on terror charges. She's the widow of one of the London bombers of 2005, and FSN's London bureau chief, Ollie Barrett, has been to her hometown of Aylesbury to find out what residents there make of her status as the world's most wanted woman.
Aylesbury is an historic market town, an hour's train ride from London, and for many years, the home of Samantha Luthwaite. For those here that knew her and know her family, like local councillor Raj Khan, it's hard to believe she could have had any involvement in incidents like the Westgate attack in Nairobi.
It's not the Samantha that we knew. She was a gentle, normal, average British young girl, lacking confidence, shy. But it's someone that we can't find. It's very difficult to accept that she's now an international wanted list. Obviously, we're waiting for evidence.
She lived on a quiet, unremarkable road in Aylesbury with Jermaine Lindsay, who would go on to become a 7/7 suicide bomber in London. At the time, Samantha Luthwaite denied all knowledge of his deadly plans, but Aylesbury residents say it's a connection to their town they wish didn't exist.
Terrorism is really bad for everybody in the world.
Angry because of the association with Aylesbury?
More angry because, yeah, because she lived locally.
It's quite scary, actually, to be honest with you. Yeah.
But while Samantha Luthwaite is wanted by several security services around the world on suspicion of terror offences, there doesn't seem yet to be any firm evidence linking her to the Westgate attacks in Nairobi. Dr. Laura Hammond is a Horn of Africa expert at SOAS University of London.
Some rumours have had her placed her inside Somalia training would-be suicide bombers, women. Others have associated her with the Mombasa 2012 bombing or a grenade attack on a bar in which 3 people were killed and 50 were injured. Because she's still at large, it's not entirely clear that she did have a role in those attacks. She may have done. And likewise, it's not clear that she was involved in the Nairobi incidents. I think information is still so sketchy that we won't know for sure.
But Jonathan Russell of extremism think tank Quilliam says she may have been involved even if she wasn't in Nairobi.
If she is in the region, given her known links to groups like Al-Shabaab and her ideology, we would suppose that she was involved in some capacity in the attacks, whether that was a direct operational role or something behind the scenes in terms of funding the attacks or using her strategic expertise.
When it comes to Aylesbury, Samantha Luthwaite's father still lives here, and the multicultural town is determined not to be divided, according to Raj Khan.
We're a rock-solid town. We're a united town. We're not going to let anything derail us.
But while Samantha Luthwaite remains on the run, her hometown remains in the spotlight. Ollie Barrett, Aylesbury.
And finally, a note about our programme that on many stations is filling the time previously occupied by Free Speech Radio News. Production of that broadcast unfortunately ceased last week, but the folks at FSRN are working hard to restructure and revive their production in the future, and you can keep in touch with them at the Free Speech Radio News website, fsrn.org. They'd love to hear from you. We would too. We are Feature Story News, an independent source of global content for a variety of TV networks, radio stations, and websites worldwide. Our editorial focus is on comprehensive coverage of the day's global events that are too often overlooked elsewhere in the media. We hope you'll join us daily here and let us know what you think of our programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. And that's FSN Reports for this Monday. On our broadcast tomorrow, the battle for press freedom in South Africa. That's tomorrow. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. Our programme was produced today by FSN's Kevin McAleese. For for everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.